head are missing, but the skirt seems to be swaying with his movement. The soft folds have been carved perfectly naturalistically, curving around his legs. This was achieved in spite of the fact that the statue is carved from one of the hardest stones, diorite. Diorite is a black rock imported from the region of ancient Magan, and it shines dramatically when polished. Several statues of Manishtushu are similar in quality and also made of diorite. The king bragged in his inscriptions about his campaign to acquire it. The statues erected in his honor were an important reason why he needed it. The artists of this time could sometimes even dispense with the straight registers that carved figures normally rested upon. A victory stele of King Naram Sin that's now in the Louvre Museum is an example of this, and it's unlike anything that came before it. Naram Sin is depicted as by far the biggest figure, and he couldn't look any more heroic. He's this muscular giant striding up a mountain, carrying his bow and arrow, stepping over the naked bodies of defeated enemies. And there's a detail to his helmet that might escape you, but it would have made a big impression on a viewer at the time. There are horns on it. This was how Mesopotamians identified gods in their artwork. They had horned helmets. So Naram Sin was saying that he was a god. He actually was deified. We know this from other sources. And that had never happened before in Mesopotamia. Supposedly, according to legend, the people made him become a god. In this sculpture, there are no ground lines, no parades of identical soldiers. The Akkadian soldiers are shown making their way up a hill, led by Naram Sin himself, climbing over the bodies of dead enemies. The artist must have observed models to get the poses right and capture the chaos of the scene. A couple of the figures are even looking back over their shoulders as they walk away. So we've seen how adventurous artists making large sculptures were, but the makers of cylinder seals were also breaking new ground at this time. Cylinder seals were very small, usually only an inch or two high, and had to be made meticulously. Tiny figures were carved carefully in relief and laid out so that the scene exactly filled the cylindrical surface, sometimes even including minute details of faces and muscles. These seals were carved with the most creative and eye-catching images of boats, goats and their herdsmen, oxen, mythical scenes, and so on. The Akkadian artists seem to have been particularly interested in scenes of intense struggle, often between heroes and animals or monsters. And they often included inscriptions written in reverse, that is, in mirror writing, so that when rolled on clay, the inscriptions turned out the right way. These gave the name of the owner of the seal and his titles. In later periods, artists made cylinder seals that were more formulaic, choosing from a much smaller repertoire of scenes. It's as though the artists of the Akkadian period were pushing themselves to see what was possible. Presumably, the statues of gods that resided in temples would have been just as finely made as the other artworks in this era, but none of them survive. These cult statues were believed to be the gods, not just images of them. In fact, there are almost no surviving cult statues from any period of Mesopotamian history. One possible exception is a marble female head that had been made back in the Uruk period between about 3500 and 2900 BCE. Her eyes, eyebrows, and hair would have been inlaid with precious materials, but these are now missing. Still, we can guess what the cult statues looked like because the images of the gods on cylinder seals probably look much the way the gods' statues looked. They suggest that the gods were slightly taller than humans, seated on thrones and wearing horned helmets. They would have been made of gold and other valuable metals and stones and dressed in fine garments. Presumably they don't survive because they were all melted down in later times when the gods were no longer worshipped. The Akkadian period is also when we get our first glimpses of the myths and legends that inspired the Mesopotamians. We know about these literary works because apprentice scribes copied the stories down in school. Probably a lot of them were simply passed down orally and don't survive. Literacy was limited, and people who could read and write used their skill to write letters and record taxes and rations, draw up contracts and so on. They didn't write fictional stories or diaries. It never seems to have occurred to them to do so. But in school, apprentice scribes practiced all kinds of different types of writing, including literature. The world's first author comes from this time period. This was Enheduanna, the daughter of Sargon, who became high priestess of the moon god. She wrote hymns and identified herself as their author, something that hadn't been done before. The writers of previous hymns, myths, and legends were all anonymous. But Enheduanna didn't put her name on the cover page, so to speak. She was part of the action of the hymn. For example, in one poem, she wrote this. Yes, I took up my place in the sanctuary dwelling. I was high priestess. I, Enheduanna. I am Enheduanna. Let me speak to you in prayer. My tears flowing like some sweet intoxicant. There are some interesting things here, beyond the fact that Enheduanna had a striking and emotional writing style. One is that she clearly was very powerful. A lesser priestess probably wouldn't have used her name over and over in a hymn. And curiously, the three hymns attributed to her aren't directed to the god she served, the moon god. They're addressed to the deity that her family seems to have been particularly dedicated to, the goddess Inanna, who was also known by her Akkadian name, Ishtar. Enheduanna seems to have turned to Inanna in a time of crisis. She wrote in the hymn that a man named Lugalane was the source of her problems. When Lugalane stood paramount, he expelled me from the temple. He made me fly out the window like a swallow. I had had my taste of life. He made me walk a land of thorns. He took away the noble diadem of my holy office. What in the world is this all about? Well, it's clear there was a political dimension to it. Enheduanna came in as an outsider, so she might have had to deal with considerable resistance within the temple. This particular individual, Lugalane, tried to drive her out of the office of high priestess. Perhaps there was also a rebellion in the city of Ur against Akkadian rule. Enheduanna was, of course, associated with her father, Sargon, so she might have been rejected by the people at the time of such a rebellion. Typically for this era, Enheduanna would have seen her difficulties as the gods doing, rather than as an act of the people. Maybe she had to go into exile, so she prayed to the goddess Inanna, the Sumerian goddess of war and love, to help her. And according to the hymn, Inanna came through for her. By the end of the composition, things had apparently been sorted out. Someone wrote that the almighty queen who presides over the priestly congregation, she accepted her prayer. This means that the goddess responded to Enheduanna's prayer. The text continues, Inanna's sublime will was for her restoration to her position in the temple. In spite of the successes of the Akkadian Empire and the cultural heights it attained, the empire was not destined to last. Instead, it would collapse after just a few generations. But that's a story for another day.
Lecture 10, The Fall of Akkad and Gudea of Lagash.
People often say that history repeats itself. But it really doesn't. If it did, historians could get rich predicting the future. Each time a set of circumstances looks similar to another event in the past, there are actually a lot of differences. Technology has changed since that past event, or groups of people are facing different challenges or have different goals. All kinds of things can influence what happens next, and almost none of it can be predicted. Politicians also often say that history teaches us something, but there are examples in history of just about every possible scenario. So, for example, someone might say that history teaches us that a wide gap between rich and poor in a society leads to rebellions by the poor, except that sometimes history teaches us that it doesn't. One thing in history does seem to repeat itself. Every powerful kingdom, empire, or state eventually falls, and others rise. The reasons may differ, But no state has managed to defy this inevitability. It's an interesting phenomenon. Ever since Edward Gibbon published the first volume of The Decline and Fall of the Roman Empire in 1776, historians have returned over and over to the reasons for the decline and fall of great states. The Akkadian Empire of ancient Mesopotamia is of particular interest because it was the world's first empire, and its kings, Sargon and Naram-Sin, have been remembered for thousands of years. The Mesopotamians themselves were sure the gods were behind the eventual collapse of the empire around 2150 BCE. Of course, in their eyes, the gods were responsible for absolutely everything. If your crops did well, you should thank the gods. If your crops failed, you should try to appease the gods. If a king wanted to conquer a neighboring city, he had the diviners check the omens and the signs to see if the gods approved. If he was successful in his conquest, he credited the god of his city with prevailing over the god of the other city. Things got more complicated when the omens said the king's army would win and the army was defeated. The omens couldn't be wrong, but the diviner could have read them incorrectly, or the gods could have changed their minds. And what about a situation in which a kingdom was attacked from outside? There wasn't much you could do but to pray to the gods, provide them with offerings, prepare your defenses, and hope that the gods were on your side. But what if an attack happened? Your city was ravaged, the king was deposed, and citizens were taken away as prisoners of war to become servants and slaves to the conquerors. How in the world did this make sense? Your city gods were supposed to protect you. Usually, people concluded not that their own gods were weaker than the other people's gods. Instead, they concluded that their own gods must have been angry with them. Someone must have done something to really upset them. This is what the Mesopotamians believed about the end of the Akkadian Empire. The fact is that the capital city of Agade was attacked, and its rule over Mesopotamia came to an end. This must have seemed incomprehensible at the time. The Akkadian Empire was a huge power. Its king was believed to be a god, and yet the empire collapsed, and the land ended up being divided into smaller kingdoms. Someone must have upset the gods. A later poem, called The Curse of Agade, blamed King Naram-Sin for angering the gods and bringing about the empire's destruction. Naram-Sin was the grandson of Sargon, and, like his grandfather, Naram-Sin spent a lot of time fighting, putting down rebellions, and trying to keep the empire together. Unlike some earlier kings, Naram-Sin didn't want to be remembered as a shepherd of his people. He'd prefer to be feared. According to the authors of the poem, Naram-Sin broke all kinds of taboos, including destroying a temple and letting people see the most holy part of it, a place that never sees the light, the place where the statue of Enlil was kept. Enlil was the king of the gods, and his city was called Nippur. The poet said that Naram-Sin made the temple collapse like a city in a floodstorm. In a way, Naram-Sin had destroyed the old temple, but he did so as part of a magnificent renovation project. He built a brand new temple in its place, decorated with incredible amounts of gold, silver, and copper statues and fittings. It was an act of devotion, not sacrilege. But the poem's authors believed Enlil was furious at what Naram-Sin had done. They wrote, "Enlil, because his beloved Angkor temple had been destroyed, what should he destroy in turn for it?" They believed that the answer was that Enlil decided to punish King Naram-Sin by destroying his capital city of Agade. Specifically, the authors said the gods summoned foreigners, Gutians, from the mountains to swarm down into the Mesopotamian river valley. In an ancient poem, the Gutians were described this way. They were, and I quote, "beings not considered people, not counted as a land. Gutium, a race who knows no order. Made like humans, but with the brains of dogs, the shapes of apes. It's interesting that the authors of the poem called the Gutians a race who knows no order. The people of Mesopotamia prized order so much, and they saw the Gutians as a force of chaos. Enlil wasn't rewarding the Gutians in this story. They were just a tool that he used in order to punish the Akkadians. Other records confirm that the attack on Agade was indeed by the Gutians, who came from the Zagros Mountains. But it didn't happen until quite a while after the reign of Naram-Sin, which ended around 2218 BCE. And the Gutians weren't the barbarians that the poem described. They had an organized military and a king to lead them. What follows in the poem is a textbook example of chaos to Mesopotamian eyes. All normal order was turned upside down. The fields didn't produce grain, prices went up, brothers turned against one another, strong men became weak, weeds grew over the streets, and no one could find a place to live in the city. Everything was destroyed. This was almost certainly an exaggeration, but it reflects the sense of crisis that they felt. Needless to say, modern historians don't think the empire fell because Enlil was angry. Something else is required to adequately explain things. Even though every empire eventually falls, each one does so for different reasons. And when examining the Akkadian Empire, the reasons for its failure are fascinating to explore. The last king of the Akkadian Empire was named Shar-Kali-Shari, the son of Naram-Sin. But we don't know a lot about him, because there are few records from his reign. Perhaps he was a successful king who was able to hold the empire together, and it fell apart only after his death. Or it could be that Agade was conquered during his lifetime. For a long time, scholars have been exploring other reasons behind the collapse of the empire, reasons in addition to the Gutian invasion, and reasons that help explain the success of that invasion. What made Mesopotamia so vulnerable at this particular time? There had always been raiders from the mountains. So what made it possible for them to successfully invade at the end of the reign of Shar-Kali-Shari? Rebellions were quite common throughout the time of the Akkadian Empire, and some are well known. King Naram-Sin himself boasted about putting one of them down. So loyalty to the empire was probably always limited. The provincial leaders would have been unlikely to fight on behalf of the Akkadian kings if those kings seemed weak. Besides, many local kings did keep their thrones during the empire. This might have been a popular move. People would have appreciated if their local leader didn't change when the city was conquered by the Akkadian kings. But it would also have meant that the local leader might try to reclaim his city's independence at any time. In 1993, an archaeologist at Yale University named Harvey Weiss published an earth-shaking article in the journal Science. Weiss and his six co-authors proposed a new explanation for the collapse of the Akkadian Empire. They'd been working at Akkadian period sites in northern Syria, an area where ancient farming was based on rainfall. And they found that many cities there had been abandoned starting around 2200 BCE because of a period of intense drought. They believed as many as 100,000 people might have become refugees because of this climatic change. And these people presumably would have moved south into Mesopotamia. Weiss and his colleagues also proposed that the Akkadian Empire was dependent for much of its grain on this region of North Syria, and that the drought could have had a powerful economic impact on the imperial administration. Even the Gutian invasion might have occurred due to the Gutians being affected by the drought and being forced to move away from their dust bowl farms. Even more striking was the author's suggestion that this drought didn't just cause the end of the Akkadian Empire. It might also have brought an end to the Old Kingdom in Egypt, the Harappan civilization in the Indus River Valley, and could have caused the collapse of states in the Aegean region and the southern Levant as well. There's plenty of evidence for the drought now. It definitely happened between 2200 and 1900 BCE. Since the time the article came out, researchers have studied sediment cores from the Gulf of Oman, the Persian Gulf, the Dead Sea, and other bodies of water, and they found a spike in wind-blown dust during this period. Wind-blown dust would have been a symptom of a loss of vegetation, which would have been caused by the drought. A big question, though, is what caused the drought? In the original article, the scientists described evidence of volcanic dust and glass at a number of sites in Syria. An analysis showed parallels to dust from volcanoes to the north in what is now Turkey. A big volcanic eruption can change the local climate for decades, and this might be what happened. In any event, most archaeologists and historians who study the ancient Near East are united in thinking that the many states that collapsed around 2200 BCE might have had environmental crises to deal with, not just political ones. Even so, the drought might not have been as catastrophic as scholars originally thought. Some archaeologists have found that plenty of sites in northern Syria continued to be occupied. Others argue that even if the drought was terrible, the Akkadian Empire wasn't all that dependent on grain from northern Syria, after all. Not enough, anyway, to have crippled the empire's economy. So we're left with a lot of questions, and also some important new ways of trying to answer them. Research has gone in a great many different directions in recent years, and historians and archaeologists are working closely with scientists in many different fields. More evidence will no doubt emerge, and will help us understand what was going on. Scientists on excavations today look at just about everything you could imagine and provide us with vastly more information than used to be possible. Pollen and carbonized seeds can tell us what grew in the region. Residues inside pots can tell us what people ate and drank. DNA from skeletons can tell us where the people came from, and so on. So, going back to the collapse of the Akkadian Empire, more than one thing could have caused it. Maybe it happened because of a domino effect of several problems and crises. But then, you could also look at it another way and say the empire was a giant experiment from the start and it didn't stand much chance of working for long. This kind of extended territorial state had never existed before in human history. Some scholars don't think the Akkadian Empire even merits the term empire, because many structures and institutions that defined later empires hadn't been invented yet. Sargon and his descendants were in uncharted territory, and it's hardly surprising that the state they created was rather fragile. Perhaps the surprise isn't that this civilization fell, but that it had survived for any length of time at all before falling. After the reign of King Sharkalishari and the invasion of the Gutians around 2100 BCE, it's unclear who ruled the region around Agade. The later Sumerian king list mentions this period in its chronicle of the many kings and dynasties of Mesopotamia. I love the way the author of the list tries to capture the uncertainty of this era. He wrote, "Who was king? Who was not king?" It must have been a chaotic time with many claimants to the throne. When the dust settled, the region was no longer unified. But a much smaller kingdom was still centered on Agade and was ruled by a king named Dudu. The Gutians had a separate state, and other independent kingdoms dotted the region that had previously been subject to Agade. Although history books tend to emphasize the times when big parts of Mesopotamia were unified under territorial states, like the Akkadian Empire and later the Ur III Kingdom, the times of smaller kingdoms were much more common and typical for this region. In this, Mesopotamia was different from Egypt. Throughout most of ancient history until the 11th century BCE, all of Egypt was usually united under a single king. The times when this was not true are called the intermediate periods, and later Egyptian writers thought of them as chaotic and disorienting. But Mesopotamia was not often unified. And, perhaps surprisingly, it seems that people's lives didn't change much, no matter whether they lived under a local kingdom or a larger empire. They still farmed and paid taxes, and were recruited for labor projects and called up into the military from time to time. At the end of the Akkadian Empire, the drought in the north certainly made life more difficult in that region, but the same doesn't seem to have been true in the south. If anything, the people of southern Mesopotamia seem to have been better off economically toward the end of the Akkadian period than they'd been during its height. And local leaders are unlikely to have mourned the end of the empire, since they'd never been thrilled to be a part of it. So although Akkadian kings and high officials must have been deeply affected, the Mesopotamian culture didn't change much. New leaders came to power, and life went on. One such dynasty of new leaders came to power in the southern kingdom of Lagash in the 22nd century BCE. It's known as the second dynasty of Lagash to distinguish it from the previous time when Lagash had been dominant, which was between around 2500 and 2300 BCE. The capital by this time wasn't the city of Lagash itself, but another city in the same kingdom, a city called Girsu. One of the kings who ruled during the second Lagash dynasty is particularly well known to modern scholars. His name was Gudea. To describe himself, he didn't use the term king, which was Lugal in Sumerian. He called himself Ensi, or governor. It's not that he was subject to a greater king. He was in charge. But he was a very pious man, and he saw his main role as being the representative on earth of his god Ningirsu. So he called himself an Ensi, not a Lugal. Still, we can refer to him as a king. You've almost certainly seen a statue of Gudea at some point, because these statues are in lots of museums around the world. Almost all of them are beautifully sculpted out of a shiny black stone called diorite. They show the king standing or seated in the prime of life. He's portrayed as having a large head on a fairly short body. He's clean-shaven, and he usually wears a cap with a wide band. He wears a tunic that looks a little like a later Roman toga, with the shoulder exposed. His upper arm is muscular, and his hands are folded in prayer. Long inscriptions on Gudea's statues explain where they were placed and why. In each instance, the statue had a name and was dedicated to a god in whose temple the statue lived. I say lived because the Mesopotamians really believed the statues had a life force. Let's look at one of the most famous of Gudea's statues. It's known to us as Statue B, but the name Gudea gave to it was a whole sentence. It was called, "For my Lord, I built this house. Life is my reward." The name explains one reason why the statue existed, to pray to the god Ningirsu, the city god of Lagash, that Gudea would enjoy a long life. And why should the god grant him a long life? Because Gudea had built a temple for him. And the statue was to tell the god the following message. At the time when I built for him his beloved house, I released all debts, cleansed all hands. For 7 days, no grain was ground. The maid was equal to her mistress. The slave stood at his master's side. I made the unclean in my city sleep outside of it. I banned all evil in it and procured justice for the gods Nanshe and Ningirsu. The orphan was not subjected to the rich. The widow was not subjected to the strong. In the household having no male heir, I made its female heir possess it. This list of the things Gudea did to celebrate the finishing of the temple is a wonderful account of his care for his people, especially the weakest among them. They were freed from their debts. Orphans and widows were protected from rich and powerful people, and women could inherit property. For 7 days, slaves were even equal to their owners. There's much more in the inscription on Statue B. It lists the daily offerings that were to be given to the statue itself. Then it describes in detail the construction of Ningirsu's temple, called the Eninu. It describes how the statue was commissioned, and it curses anyone who would remove the statue from the temple, or who would erase Gudea's name from the statue, and it praises Ningirsu. The audience for the inscription was partly the god himself. The writing has a sort of magical quality. Gudea knew the statue would outlive him, and that its inscription would continue to remind Ningirsu about who had built his home for him. But Gudea was also writing to people in the future to inform them about the offerings they would need to continue to provide for the statue as part of his worship, and about his greatness as the builder of the Eninu. And Gudea was trying to control the future by asking the gods to curse anyone who tried to take credit for his achievements. He was successful in a way. We do remember him. Here am I talking about him and reading you his inscription. We're not making offerings to the statue anymore. And the statue is in the Louvre in Paris, and that's a long way from Mesopotamia. So he didn't get everything he wanted, but he is remembered for building the Eninu temple. The materials for the temple came from all over the known world, according to the statue inscription. There were huge logs from Lebanon that had been tied together into rafts and floated down the Euphrates. They became the roof beams of the temple. There were blocks of stone from the west, copper from the south, and black wood from the Indus Valley. Imported gold, lapis lazuli, and bitumen were used as well. There's no reason to think Gudea lied about any of this. He obviously traded widely to get access to the goods he needed. His kingdom must have been rich in order to pay for it all. The most striking feature of Statue B is that Gudea has a big rectangular tablet on his lap. There's a measuring stick and a stylus lying on it. And inscribed on the tablet is a floor plan of the temple. Gudea was showing that he was responsible for the design of the Eninu, but he didn't invent it himself. He says in the inscription that the plan for the temple came to him directly from the god on a lapis lazuli tablet in a dream. One thing that many inscriptions mention is that Gudea chose to have his statues made out of stone instead of metal. This tells us that metal was the normal material for a royal statue. On Statue B, he wrote, "For this statue, nobody was supposed to use silver or lapis lazuli. Neither should copper or tin or bronze be a working material. It is exclusively of diorite. Nobody will forcibly damage the stone." This helps explain why we have so many statues of Gudea and relatively few of the kings who ruled before or after him. Metal statues must have been normal, but they would have been melted down in later centuries. In contrast, diorite is a really hard stone. Gudea could be pretty sure that his statues would survive. While I focused on Statue B, dozens of other Gudea statues have also been found, and he was said to have built innumerable temples. We know of 30 temples that he claimed to have built in just the city of Girsu, where the Eninu was located. He also commissioned buildings in many other cities, including in Ur, Nippur, and Uruk. So Gudea must have controlled quite a lot of southern Mesopotamia. Did Gudea have any other preoccupations besides worshipping the gods, building temples, protecting the weak, and establishing widespread trade? Was there a darker side to him? It seems not. We know of only one military campaign during this entire era, and Gudea never depicted himself in artworks as a warrior or a war leader. Mostly, he and his subjects seem to have enjoyed a time of peace. Before moving on, it's important to mention something else about Gudea. One royal inscription from his reign is considered to be a literary masterpiece. It was written on two big, hollow terracotta cylinders. The bigger one is 24 inches tall, and each is about 13 inches in diameter. The inscription is usually referred to with the rather boring name of Gudea Cylinder A and B, though it's also called by its ancient name, the Building of Ningirsu's House. The text is the longest known inscription up to that time. It's 1,363 lines long, and in a modern translation, extends across more than 50 pages. These cylinders were found in 1877, probably in the ruins of the Eninu temple, and they're now at the Louvre in Paris. Scholars believe several different scribes must have been responsible for writing on them, because the text is written in several different handwriting styles. The cylinder inscription is all about the building of the Eninu temple, like the inscription on Statue B. But the cylinder adds a whole complicated myth, including the dreams that Gudea is said to have received to guide him in the construction. And the cylinder inscription describes the great ceremonies held when the god was brought into his new temple and the seven-day festival that took place. Although Gudea completely dominates our knowledge of the second dynasty of Lagash, he wasn't its only king. He ruled for perhaps 20 years, after which his son, Ur-Ninghirsu, took the throne. Only a few statues of Ur-Ninghirsu survive. Soon after his reign, the second dynasty of Lagash was conquered by a king who had taken power in the city of Ur, and who founded a powerful royal family, the third dynasty of Ur. Gudea is important because he was so different in the way he presented himself to his subjects from the Akkadian kings who came before him. He didn't try to seem terrifying. He didn't claim to be the king of the universe. He didn't tear down city walls and drag kings into captivity in neck stocks. He wanted to protect his subjects, and he loved his gods. This is a model of rule that seems to have influenced many kings who came after him.
Lecture 11, Ur 3, Households, Accounts, and Ziggurats.
The cuneiform writing system is among the most important cultural contributions of Mesopotamian society. The number of cuneiform documents surviving from the early dynastic period, the time of the earliest city-states, from around 2900 to 2350 BCE, is relatively small. More survive from the time of the Akkadian Empire and the second dynasty of Lagash, which followed. But when we come to the next major era of Mesopotamian history, the documentation positively explodes. This was a period when Mesopotamia was dominated by a dynasty that ruled from the city of Ur in the southern part of modern-day Iraq. It's known as the third dynasty of Ur, the Ur III period for short. And it lasted a little more than a century, from around 2112 to 2004 BCE. Not many of these cuneiform texts record poems or hymns or myths. Instead, most are administrative. A huge number of them come from the Ur III period. And studied as a large group, these documents reveal amazing details about the economy and administration of the era. In fact, more than 120,000 cuneiform tablets written during the time are estimated to have been found so far. And they're housed all over the place. One study discovered that 545 different collections, museums, and libraries around the world have tablets from the Ur III period. A lot of them were sold on the antiquities market over the past 150 years or so. I learned to read the ancient languages in graduate school, and I use cuneiform in my research. Several times during my career, I've been asked by a curator of a small museum or by a librarian if I'd look at a cuneiform tablet in their collection to see what it says. In just about every case, the tablet turns out to be from the Ur III period. And like almost all of these tablets, it records some commodities received by a temple or palace, or delivered to an individual or an institution, or it records payments made to workers. The tablets were drawn up every day, apparently in every palace and temple and government office in the Ur III kingdom. And they listed the receipt and distribution of individual items. Where did the goods come from? Where were they going to be sent? Who were they being given to? What was the date when this happened? Who oversaw it? All this information was meticulously recorded on small tablets that were stored together. Here's a typical example of a transaction. It uses the standard measurements of the time, barig, ban, and sila. 2 barig, 2 bun, 2 sila of clarified butter, 3 barig of cheese, deficit of the herdsman or canara. After the individual transaction records were created, the information was combined into big ledgers. This usually happened once a month. None of these tablets was intended to survive. The scribes didn't write them thinking about how people in the future might view them. They were purely functional, yet they did survive. It's as though a bunch of individual W-2 forms in an accountant's office were to survive for 4,000 years, and future historians tried to reconstruct the modern world based on those forms. You can imagine the kinds of things they would observe. So, this person was paid some amount for working at a particular company. This other person was paid more. This is how much they paid in taxes. This is who oversaw their work. A future historian would have lots of questions. What lies behind those names? What were their working conditions? What did they care about? There's so much missing. That's true for the Ur III texts as well. What we do know is that thousands and thousands of men and women worked for different aspects of the central and provincial administrations in some way or another. They worked in the military or as builders, farmers, herdsmen, religious functionaries, officials, scribes, artisans, or servants. Each province in the kingdom paid taxes to the central government, but the provinces didn't all owe their taxes on the same day. In Mesopotamia, there was no equivalent of the April 15th deadline. Instead, each province was responsible for paying during a particular month. These taxes supported the government for that month. In the next month, it was the turn of another province. This meant that wealth was coming in year-round. Taxes were paid in goods, not in silver. So the administration built a whole town to cope with the goods coming in and the goods going out. It was called Puzrishdagan and was close to the religious capital city of Nippur. A huge number of tablets survived from the main offices there. Boats were constantly being unloaded, herds of animals shepherded around, granaries were being filled and emptied. Every item that arrived or left Puzrishdagan was recorded, and these records were filed and later compiled. Scholars used to think the Ur III period was a time of tyrannical kings who controlled every aspect of the economy. They reasoned that if every single goat and cow had to be accounted for among the huge herds of animals that passed through Puzrishdagan and every other town, then some megalomaniac, a very successful megalomaniac, must have been behind this process. But contemporary scholars have revised this view. Although the Third Dynasty of Ur was a time when a lot of changes took place, the kings didn't rule with an iron hand. They had to work within an existing system that included powerful temples and governors with whom the king's administration negotiated. The first king of the Ur III dynasty was named Ornama. He and his son Shulgi built an empire. It was the first one since the Akkadian Empire, which had been built by King Sargon in the 24th century BCE. Ornama and Shulgi took over much of southern and central Mesopotamia and extended the borders of their land to the region around the ancient city of Susa in what is now western Iran. But scholars disagree about how successful the Ur III dynasty rulers were in controlling their empire. Shulgi certainly spent a lot of time on campaign during his reign, but not necessarily conquering new lands. He might have been trying to retain control of existing domains that were constantly trying to leave the empire. Mesopotamia wasn't easily unified, and each aspiring emperor had difficulties in maintaining control of the lands he conquered. Ur III kings didn't boast about territorial conquests, and in this, they were nothing like King Sargon. Instead, the Ur III kings claimed that they liberated the lands they took over. They adopted a tone in their inscriptions that was more like some of the kings of Lagash from the early dynastic period, or like the more recent king, Gudea, who'd ruled Lagash from around 2144 to 2124 BCE. The ruler's main goal, they said, was to protect the weak people in society from strong individuals and institutions that might exploit them or hurt them. So the kings didn't want to be seen as fierce tyrants. They were kind shepherds. They promoted this image by creating a new kind of royal inscription that was probably displayed in public. It's usually called a law code in history books, but it wasn't called a law code when it was first created. It started with a prologue, all about King Orname and his great achievements. The statement ended this way. I did not deliver the orphan to the rich. I did not deliver the widow to the mighty. I did not deliver the man with but one shekel to the man with one mina, that is 60 shekels. I eliminated enmity, violence, and cries for justice. I established justice in the land. What the king emphasized here was how good he was to his people. Then he added a new type of statement to the inscription. Immediately after the prologue, he wrote, "At that time, if a man commits a homicide, they shall kill that man." And a few lines later, "If a man divorces his first-ranking wife, he shall weigh and deliver 60 shekels of silver." These obviously are laws. They're phrased in the same way as most of the laws in the Bible. If someone does a particular thing, then this or that punishment or fine will be imposed. But when Orname's inscription was written, it might not have been obvious that the statements constituted laws. They seem instead to have been listed as concrete examples of how Orname was going to protect his people and establish justice. There's nothing in the inscription to say the rules had to be followed by judges in court. Today, Orname is often considered to be the man who invented laws. But these laws don't ever seem to have been copied individually in ancient times. And they didn't ever appear without the prologue. So the inscription seems to have been thought of as a whole unit, not as a collection of laws that could be quoted and analyzed separately. The laws were part of the king's proclamation as to how he would rule and why his subjects should trust him. They weren't used like a modern law code at all. The king needed his people's support, and they benefited from the order he brought to their lives, as reflected in these clauses. Rather than being rules to be enforced, they were probably legal precedents based on past court cases. The courts had already existed for centuries before this proclamation and functioned well without the need for written laws. And so, rather than directly consult the king's decrees, the judges continued to decide cases based on the evidence and on past precedents. The Ur III kings also tried other new things to claim their legitimate right to rule, without terrorizing the population as the Akkadian kings had done. It's during this period that a compilation of the names of kings and the cities they ruled, going back to the beginning of civilization, seems to have been written. This is the Sumerian king list. But it isn't historically accurate. It presents an idealized past in which Mesopotamia was always unified, with kingship over the land passing smoothly from one city to another, and with each in turn becoming capital of the whole land. This wasn't true, of course. For most of history, the land had been divided into small kingdoms and city-states that warred with one another. Still, the ideal of unity was useful. If people believed it was normal for all of Mesopotamia to be ruled by one dynasty, then they'd be less likely to rebel against the Ur III kings who really had unified the land under their rule. Orname boasts in the prologue to his laws that he standardized weights and measures. This was another way to promote order and unity across the land and to make sure the kingdom ran smoothly. At the time, it seems, all the Mesopotamian cities already used shekels and minas to weigh things. There were 60 shekels in a mina, and a mina weighed about 1 pound. But the minas weren't uniform. A mina in one city might weigh slightly more than a mina in another city. The temples kept standard sets of weights and measures, but until this time, they had applied to only one particular region. You can see why Ornama and Shulgi would want the same standards to apply everywhere. If people were paying taxes and they had different conceptions of what, say, a mina or a shekel was, or what constituted a bushel of barley, then what arrived at the palace as payment might be less than expected. Trade would also be easier if everyone had the same set of weights and measures. You wouldn't need to keep converting from one standard to another. The kings also attempted to create a single calendar to be used everywhere in the kingdom. At that time, years weren't numbered. Instead, each year was named for a significant achievement by the king. Since many documents were dated, the year names provided the subjects with a constant reminder of the king's greatness. Some year names referred to a king's pious works for the gods, like appointing priests or priestesses, or restoring temples. Other year names mentioned marriages between the king's daughters and other rulers. And there were year names about building city walls. But a lot of them were about conquests of cities. They show that the Ur III kings were more warlike than their other inscriptions would have us believe. In their drive to standardize things, the central administration even seems to have unified building techniques. There were standardized types and sizes of bricks and innovations in the construction of public buildings. The builders started baking bricks for the exterior walls instead of just drying them in the sun. And they added strategic holes in the structures to allow the interior bricks, which were sun-dried, to continue to dry out even after the building was constructed. The kings sponsored the construction of huge pyramid-shaped temple towers in many of the cities. These were called ziggurats, and they were constructed next to the great temples of the gods. Each ziggurat was a solid mass of brick built in 4 or 5 giant steps, probably with a small shrine on the top. They were built on a scale that had never been seen before in Mesopotamia. The ziggurat at the capital city of Ur was particularly magnificent. It was maybe 100 feet tall, and its base measured 210 feet by 148 feet. The lower level was reconstructed recently in the 20th century, and it gives you a sense of the huge scale of the operation. It's been estimated that 1,000 men would have to have worked for almost 5 months straight to deliver and place the bricks for just the first stage of the ziggurat. These hundreds of builders were supported by brickmakers, rope makers, cooks, water carriers, physicians, a whole community, and all of these people had to be fed and housed by the administration. It was a colossal undertaking. The ziggurats going up all over the kingdom must have made a huge impression on the people. The landscape in southern Mesopotamia is absolutely flat. Only the occupation mounds where the cities were located would have risen above the flat plain. You'd have seen them from far away as you walked along the roads or sailed on the rivers or canals. The cities would stand out on the horizon. And now these big stepped temple towers rose up in the center like artificial mountains, testifying to the power of the king and proving his love for the gods and showing off the organization of his administration. The kings also commissioned royal tombs near the temples. These were dug underground with steps leading down into the rooms with vaulted ceilings. Unfortunately, the tombs were robbed long ago, but archaeologists have found the remains of gold leaf, lapis lazuli, and agate. These remnants reveal that the walls would have been covered with gold and semi-precious stones, and the ceilings were painted with stars. The tombs would have been spectacular houses for the kings to live in after death. In trying to convince the population to support them, the Ur III kings reinstituted an idea that had begun with Sargon's grandson, King Naram-Sin of Akkad. Starting with King Shulgi, rulers had scribes write a divine symbol in front of their names because they wanted to be viewed as gods. They even claimed to have superhuman powers. Shulgi had a hymn composed in his honor that is sometimes called the King of the Road. In it, he mentions two festivals that took place on the same day, one in the city of Ur and the other in Nippur. the divine king decided to celebrate both by running from one city to the other and back in a single day. This was a distance of 100 miles. That's 200 miles round trip. So the feat simply was not possible. Besides which, King Shulgi described a huge hailstorm that blew in as he ran. Being divine, of course, he claimed that he achieved his goal and made it to Nippur and back, celebrating both festivals on the same day with no problem. Scribes studied and copied this hymn in school, along with others like it. 48 such royal poems have been found, all extolling the greatness of the Ur Three Kings. The kings also wanted to show how pious they were, and that they were loved and chosen by the gods. A new image that shows up on steles and cylinder seals at this time is known as the presentation scene. In it, a god or goddess is seated on a throne, with the king standing in front, and another minor goddess leading him or standing behind him. The king is shown praying to the god, or pouring a libation to the deity. Sometimes the god is depicting handing a rod and a ring to the king. These were the symbols of authority and power. Even though the Ur Three Kings were supposed to be divine, they still had to work with all the other parts of government and society to make things run smoothly. They didn't simply proclaim things and assume they would be done. Mesopotamia didn't work that way. You can think of Mesopotamia at this time as a conglomeration of households. At the family level, the household is easy to conceive of. A typical Mesopotamian household consisted of a married couple and their children living together. With them were elderly relatives, along with unmarried aunts and maybe some servants. The oldest male relative, the grandfather or father of the family, was head of the household. But the house was an economic unit, not just a social one. If the family owned fields or animals, then those provided food. If the family was involved in some other profession, as artisans or scribes or merchants, then the work was often performed in the home. Even officials who worked for the court seem to have done at least some of their work at home rather than in an office at the palace. The term for house in Sumerian is eh, so each house was thought of as the eh of the patriarch. Every temple was also an eh. These temples all had names and each started with the word house. So the temple of the moon god at Ur was the Egeshurgal, the house of the great light. The temple of the great god Enlil at Nippur was the Ekur, or mountain house. The temple of the goddess Inanna at Uruk was the Eanna, or house of heaven. And the temples weren't only houses for the gods. They also had households with dependents and land and herds of animals. These could represent immense resources. The head of the temple household was the high priest or priestess. Some religious leaders were appointed by the king, but not all. So the king had to negotiate with the temple households, which controlled a great deal of the wealth of the kingdom. Governors of provinces were also patriarchs of their own households, their palaces and the estates. The word for palace in Sumerian was e-gal, great house. A governor had considerable autonomy in ruling his province and was perceived as the father of his giant household. We see this, for example, in texts from the city of Uma, which had been a longtime rival of the city of Lagash in previous centuries. About 15,000 cuneiform tablets from the Ur III period were found in Uma, and the majority of them record the administrative dealings of the governor's household. Scholars learn from examining these tablets that the governor had authority over almost everything in his province, including the temple. He also controlled a lot of offices that oversaw almost all aspects of the economy. He administered offices for specific products, such as leather, wool, animals, and grain. And there were offices of agriculture, boats, and labor. A fiscal office coordinated it all, keeping track of taxes and payments. It was a very orderly system. Imagine dozens of officials and scribes employed in a hierarchical system, paying attention to all the food produced, all the objects manufactured, all the people employed, all the boats commissioned, all the buildings constructed, and recording it meticulously so nothing got lost, No payment was missed. Although the great kings of the Urthri dynasty ruled over Umma and received taxes from the province, their names aren't mentioned much in the documents found there. One of the only places the names of the kings show up is in the dates on